knock off. Anyway, but yeah, the lithium would be nice. But the only thing I've seen in lithiums for this radio would be the single-use AA's. I can't get a battery pack for this radio, a lithium battery pack for this particular radio, but I do understand they're making them for a lot of the newer radios. And, you know, the thing that bothers me is batteries over the time, that the electronics have been advancing in leaps and bounds, but the batteries are lagging, really lagging behind. They're really the bane of electronics, keeping us in the dark ages, in a way, you know, the battery situation. But I see they are getting better, though, with the, like Eric was talking about, the polymer. That's promising. And with that... What was that?
Where's your radio timing in?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I have a timeout timer, I think, of 2 minutes on the radio, so I guess it's kind of good that I don't time out the repeater. But yeah, so with the electric cars coming around, there's a lot more research and development going on in the battery industry, and I think that'll help everybody down the line, not just the car industry, the auto industry. So I think we'll all benefit from that. And the prices will get lower, and the sizes will get smaller, and, you know, 25 years from now, we'll say, oh, man, can you remember those AA's that we used to use that only gave you 3,000 milliamp hours? So, yeah, that's I'm going to be doing quite a bit of research in the future, and I'll keep you guys updated. So this is KE2KB sending it back to the TechNet.
Yeah, thank you for that offer, Frank. Rich, K2UPS, he does quite a bit of battery-operated portable equipment with his nice compact rigs. I'm going to turn it over to Rich and see if he's got any words of wisdom on what batteries are his favorite. K2UPS, I hope you're within range of us from Ohio. K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
K2UPS Mobile, yep, still here, Dick. Well, I use in my KX3, I use the Sony Analoops that I think are in a 2500 milliamp hour range, AA size. And they work out just fine for that. I can get up with about 5 or 6 hours operating out of a set of 8 of those in that radio at QRP levels. In my HTs, I also use the Analoops in one of the Kenwood HTs I have. But like the gentleman mentioned, the batteries are, at least in the case that I have, are a little bit big. And it's meant to take regular alkaline batteries, not rechargeables. And the rechargeables apparently are slightly longer. They fit, but the battery case is slightly deformed, and it doesn't really want to fit in the radio snugly and release properly. But there's some good batteries out there. Batteryuniversity.com, there's a lot of good information out on all the different types of chemicals, chemistry that they're using. And you might, I don't know how many different sites you've looked at for that FT60, but there might be a lithium pack available. There used to be the guy at W&W Batteries, had a place right next to you could walk into. Now he just does online stuff, but if anybody would have it, he might. Back to that.
No, the best part of AA.
Go ahead, Eric. The best part of AA is AA.
How do you
spell
that?
Put them in something, and then you forget about them. Then you go to use the thing 6 months later, and you see all this white and green stuff all over it. It makes you almost want to throw the whole thing out. You're about to use
it. So I think you're saying that some of these exotic chemistry AA batteries, don't put them in there and put it on a shelf and forget them for 6 months. You might be in trouble. I heard a voice of someone else saying something. Who was that? K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
It's KC2SHO, John in Mount Laurel. Yeah, how do you spell that? I hear you guys saying inner loop, interloop, inner loop. I'm not sure. I'm trying to put together the spelling of that word.
Eric, you want to answer that question for him?
Repeat it for me. I wasn't listening. I'm sorry.
We keep talking about a kind of battery called inner loop. He wants to know how is that spelled.
Inner loop? I'm not familiar with that, so. If I was going to spell it, I'd spell it just as it sounds, inner loop. Sorry, I don't know anything about it.
It's inner loop. E-N-E-L-O-O-P. Echo Lima Echo Lima with an E-N-E. Echo Lima Echo. A-N, oh, I'm sorry, Echo Nancy Echo Lima Oscar Oscar Papa.
Sounds like a trade name, but I'll look it up.
Yeah, you asked a darn good question, Jonathan. Let's see if we get an answer from the crowd.
Eneloop is currently made by Panasonic. It was made by Sanyo, but the Sanyo company sold their brand over to Panasonic.
Okay, and it's Eric that's looking that up, and Eric is the next guy on the list. So for two reasons, we're going to go to you, Eric, KE2EJ, with your question and or information. K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, and I can't do both things at the same time. I'll look that up later. My question is for you, Dick, and I suspect that you're really on top of this, and it's something that you'd be very familiar with. It's just I had the opportunity to work on something like this, and I'd rather difficulty in making it go. But anyway, let's talk about negative resistance oscillators. You want to go there? I mean, it is sort of complex. K2RIW, KE2EJ.
Yeah, I've lived with those way back in the dark ages of tunnel diodes. There was a kind of a tunnel diode free-running oscillator that was extremely easy to set up as a frequency memory system. And at Airborne Instruments Laboratory in the late 60s, we were working on that system. So, and that nowadays, by way of a bulk effect devices, each of your, many of your solid-state oscillators, your X-band, KU-band solid-state oscillators, or bulk effect, as I call them, really running on negative resistance. So go right ahead, Eric. KE2EJ, KE2RIW.
DPZ, Dynatron oscillators.
Yeah, there's many ways. Dynatron is one of the many ways you can hook up a tube, or a special kind of a tube, that will act as a negative resistance, which means it really wants to oscillate as long as you put the right kind of a passive tuned circuit connected to it. Go ahead, Eric. KQRIW.
Dynatron, if I remember, is the region between, it's a tetrode. Between the two. Anyway, I was working on this 12-gig microwave at a time. I found that, interestingly enough, I couldn't get the thing to kick over until I pulled the diode out, dumped it in alcohol, cleaned it up, and put it back in. And yet then, it would oscillate, but it would oscillate everywhere, not where I wanted it to.
First of all, what I think you ran into is that if the device that is your negative resistance component, which is going to be the major component of your oscillator, it's like the amplifying section, so to speak. If there's any positive resistance in series with it because of battery contacts, yes. If I had a device that acted like minus 1.5 ohms negative, so to speak, and I put that in series with a 1.6 ohm resistor, the combination of those two is now a positive resistance, and it will not oscillate. So I am guessing that's what you ran into. When you finally get the right amount of negative resistance, you're now going to worry about the fact that it's got multiple modes of oscillating. If your particular tuned circuit has the slightest amount of resonance on some other frequency, other than your desirable frequency, simultaneous with your desirable frequency.
Waveguide.
Okay, if your main resonator is waveguide, the good news about waveguide is that it's the world's most beautiful high-pass filter. If I built a cavity resonator for, let me pick a number, 10 gigahertz, no way in hell am I going to break into oscillation at 5 gigahertz because the waveguide is acting beyond cutoff. In other words, it's a huge attenuator at lower frequencies than the cutoff frequency of the waveguide. However, every chunk of waveguide with a short circuit or an open circuit on the two ends, so that now you have what we all call a cavity resonator, the signal can bounce back and forth and stay in step. There's a zillion different waveguide modes as they go higher and higher frequency, all the way up to optical and beyond. that waveguide will support that mode of propagation. So in the most extreme case, if you've got a real high-quality negative resistance device that's still negative resistance at 10 times your desired frequency, and if your particular waveguide resonator has a mode of resonance at 10 times that frequency, it's going to go there periodically, unless you put in a mode killer. There are various ways of recognizing what the undesired higher frequency mode of your waveguide is supporting. Let me drop. There's a whole art and science called mode killing. If you go to the book called Southward, I keep forgetting the name of the darn book. It's a 1945 or 1950 book, not McGraw-Hill. I can't think of the other science company. But Southward is the name of the author of this book on a zillion waveguide microwave techniques. I think it's something like microwave engineering, a title a little bit like that. I can go to my bookshelf and get the darn thing and give you the exact title.
Principles and application of waveguide transmission.
Principles and application of waveguide transmission. Beautiful. By Southward. What's Southward's first name? Here we go, John. Here's a trivia question. Mr. Southworth, what's his first name?
I don't know. That I don't know. And it's Nordstrom.
And aren't there some letters in front of Nordstrom, the publisher? Okay, so back to the book you go to, and there's a whole section in there called Waveguide Mode Killing. If you recognize the fact that your particular round, rectangular, or whatever waveguide has higher frequency modes where it will support a signal, and therefore if you've made it into a cavity resonator, you will get spurious modes of resonance. There are ways of putting a mode killer in it. You could kill the propagation of those higher frequencies if you put the right kind of a doodad inside of your waveguide. So that's a possible way of killing those undesired modes of oscillation. I wonder if that makes some sense, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Yes, it does, but since you're taking the approach of a design engineer, here we have a piece of gear that used to work perfectly fine without doing anything special to it. But I'm thinking about just the basic oscillator itself in terms of its circuits. If we were going to draw a schematic of it, the way I would envision it is the tank circuit for this thing, which really is the waveguide, is sort of a parallel resonant capacitor and a coil and some resistive load. So there's got to be something, because if you measure the bias voltage on the diode, it's almost in the right place. It's not exactly in the right place, but it's almost in the right place according to the specifications of what's there. And it's just a mechanical assembly, so what am I missing? Should I be just taking the whole assembly and scrubbing it down, literally? Are we talking about, you know, some magical layer of stuff on a waveguide? That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Help me here, Dick.
Left-handedly, Eric, you may have given us a clue. Almost any of the bulk effect devices that I know of, tunnel diode-like device, is extremely sensitive to the exact amount of bias voltage. If you're not in that magic region of the exact amount of bias voltage, you go a little bit too high, the negative resistance goes away and it becomes positive. You go a little bit too low, the negative resistance goes away and it can jump into what's called the switching mode, where it hops in and hops out of the negative resistance region, so that your load line of your resonator is a slanted line across the voltage current curve. Your actual bulk effect device, your tunnel diode, has got the squiggly curve in the middle. You've got to be very careful with the exact amount of bias. So for every tunnel diode-like device, you've got to hit the exact amount of bias voltage, and that bias supply must have an impedance much lower than the negative resistance of the diode. Otherwise, you'd be flipping into the so-called switching mode, where it hops into the right region and hops out of the right region. So that bias network, you better make sure it is in absolutely perfect condition and giving you the right impedance and the right voltage otherwise all hell breaks loose with that. That's the critical portion of a tunnel diode oscillator, that bias supply. So if anything has happened to change that bias network, it can get you into a heap of trouble there, Rick. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. All right, thank you. K2RIW, K2EJ. You know, it's making sense. Now I'm thinking about it because what I mentioned was the rate of bias current. Bias voltage is where it's supposed to be. You can see the current jumping up and down. And really, in essence, it comes from a constant voltage source, not a constant current source. Now, I've got some clues in my head as to where to go, so I think we just picked out the... We're just picking in the right neighborhood, if you know what I mean. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Yeah, if you really got the data sheet for that exact tunnel diode, and it tells you that it's supposed to be biased at 1.45 voltage, I'm picking numbers out of the air, and when you're at 1.45 voltage with a very stiff, constant voltage bias power supply, and that at that power supply it's supposed to be drawing 15 milliamps, and if yours is drawing some other current for that exact serial number, that's a strong clue that something funny is going on. And if you put your very high frequency oscilloscope across that bias network, you may find out that it's in a blocking oscillator mode, that you think you've got a constant amount of bias voltage because your digital voltmeter reads some kind of puck.
Yeah, let's go, but I can only see 200 megahertz. I can't get higher than that.
Maybe you got to look at it with a sniffing coil on into a spectrum analyzer. But if that bias network is in the so-called switching mode, your readings will be almost right. But boy, can that really help you get into spurious modes as far as the RF is concerned, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, we're making a lot of sense. There is a hunk of ferrite that actually feeds the diode mounted in the end stub of the cavity. And the power leaf comes in through a hunk of ferrite. There's a choke and stuff behind it. Yeah. What we're talking about here, I think, is something that I have to dig into a little bit more deeply. Possibly taking what the impedance of the diode is, just using a resistive load and testing it in that form. I can definitely measure the current pretty accurately, you know, just by using a series of resistors and single readings across that with the scope or with a voltmeter. There's lots of different ways to approach this, but I think that's kind of the right idea. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Yeah, they're very critical on that bias network. So it's a simple looking circuit that can give you a lot of very high frequency oscillation. Back in the days when you didn't have transistors that would go there, you think that, gee, you found this beautiful solution. You suddenly realize the oscillator is simple, but the bias network is complicated. You got to be very careful with it. So good luck with that. Let us know how that turns out, Eric.
I will, but I think for the benefit of the people listening, why don't you give them a real short little idea of what a negative resistance oscillator is?
Okay, there are certain kinds of tunnel diodes, negative resistance diodes, bulk effect devices. There are certain kinds of chunks of material that have only two leads coming out of it. And if you try to plot the voltage current curve, if I had a pure 1-ohm resistor and I graph what it does, I might have voltage from 0 to 10 volts on the horizontal scale and amperes 0 to 10 amps on the vertical scale. And if I plot the characteristic of that resistor, I'll get a 45 degree sloping line starting off at the origin at the lower left hand corner and a 45 degree sloping line going up to the right. So anywhere along that curve, I get this 1-ohm resistor. I look at the curve and it tells me if I go slide over here to the right where I get 5 volts and I go up to the curve and I find out where it intercepts and I go over to the left, I'll see it's 5 amperes. So you know, you've got an exact number of volts versus ampere characteristic for a pure 1-ohm resistor in my example. Okay, you unplug that 1-ohm resistor in that exact same circuit and you plug in this so-called tunnel diode, this negative resistance device. And you'll see that it starts off at the origin, where for the first few millivolts, for the first maybe 1 volt, it goes up at a normal 45 degree line. And then as you put higher voltage on this device, instead of the current going up, the current goes around the corner and starts going back down. And so at some higher voltage, maybe 1.5, 1.8 volts, it hits negative, it hits minimum current. And then when you go to higher voltage again, the current starts rising again. So you get this dip in the curve. You get a region where the curve is going down, more voltage in, gives you less current being drawn. That's what negative resistance is. You increase the voltage.
Repeater, time out.
I'm double checking, and yeah, we still got the Eastern repeater. You increase the voltage in this particular region. You increase the voltage and the current goes down. That's called negative resistance. And so every oscillator, whenever you take a, whenever you're building an oscillator with conventional circuits, an oscillator consists of an amplifier with a feedback network. Usually the feedback network determines what frequency it's going to oscillate on, because it's a tuned circuit. It'll only give you feedback over a certain frequency region. But if you now walk around the loop of an ordinary oscillator with an amplifier in it, you'll find out that you have greater than unity gain around the loop. The amount of feedback is a little bit less than the amount of forward gain. So therefore, you've got a positive loop gain circuit. And by definition, it'll start oscillating somewhere, and the oscillation will keep getting stronger and stronger because you've got positive gain up to the point where your amplifying device goes into limiting. Other than that, it would go to infinity and burn up your circuit. So every real amplifier has a certain amplitude beyond which it no longer has gain. That's where it starts going into limiting. Every oscillator that you build in a conventional circuit does that. Let me drop it. But now if you study that whole circuit of the forward gain of the amplifier and the feedback network, there are people who analyze that as a kind of synthesized negative resistance circuit. It's not an easy analysis. But there are certain kinds of bulk effect devices. There are certain kinds of diodes where as you go beyond the normal forward current of the diode, or backward current, one or the other, where it gets this crazy curve of voltage versus current, which has got the negative resistance region. And if you can bias it carefully into that negative resistance region, and the region where more voltage in gives you less current drawn, if you can make it sit in that region and put a tuned circuit across it, it now has gain. Anything with negative resistance is a two-dimensional. It's got a resonant frequency, and the bell rings for a while, but it slowly damps that down to a lower and lower amplitude. If you could connect a negative resistance device across it, instead of the bell going weaker in amplitude, it goes up in amplitude, if you know what I mean. Well, that bell is really the tuned circuit. So, not super easy to understand, but I guarantee if you Google the word negative resistance oscillator, you'll find out. I'm pretty sure you'll find a whole lot of circuits, and you'll find a whole lot of articles on the internet on that exact subject. So, in the early days, if I needed a oscillator to run as a pump oscillator for my parametric amplifier, and I needed an oscillator at 90 gigahertz to make my param work correctly. I needed an oscillator at 90 gigahertz. And let me pick a number, 1970. There were no transistors you could buy that will oscillate at 90 gigahertz. But tunnel diodes would go there easily. So a tunnel diode-like oscillators at 90 gigahertz were relatively easy to build in the 1970 time frame. And the Airborne Instruments Laboratory parametric amplifier, and by the way, there's one of those flying on every one of the space shuttles, an AIL parametric amplifier, and they also use the AIL microwave scanning beam landing system in order to get that space shuttle down to that runway, because you only get one chance to land with the space shuttle. It's got no motor. You better line yourself up to that runway just right. You take your one chance to land on that field. You overshoot or undershoot that field, you're in a heap of trouble. So the circuit that tells you when you're flying too high, too low, too far to the left, too far to the right, the circuit that gave you that information was was the AIO microwave scanning beam landing system. And the parametric amplifier that supported that on the shuttle had a negative resistance bulk effect oscillator in there that supported that paramp. So these things have been around for a long time, and they gave us frequencies we couldn't get to by any other means in the early days. Let me drop. So I give you a little bit of the information on that. The next person on our list was Joe, KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Go right ahead, Joe. K2RIW in the deck then.
Yeah, roger that. My question to you, Dick, is in September, I'm going to take my, I'm going to upgrade to a extra class license. My question to you is, do they still mail you a physical paper, like a paper license that I can hang up on my wall? Or, because I know lately it's going green, and it seems like, I don't know if I'm going to get the extra class license in the mail, or, okay, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the last time I updated, which was quite a number of years ago, and I think we're now in a stage where every update now lasts for 10 years. I think it used to only be for 5. So I got a paper certificate back then. Are they still issuing paper certificates today? Even if at worst they don't do it, I'll bet you there's a method by which you can request a paper certificate, something you can carry in your wallet so that you can flash when you go to a particular facility where you need a license to do what you're about to do, and you want to prove to somebody you've got that license. You'd like to have something in your pocket that you can prove. So I'll bet you, even if they don't issue it, I'll bet you there's a way you can request it. Anybody out there know whether or not the FCC these days is issuing a paper certificate for your license upgrade? And if they don't, is there a way you can request it? Give me a call letters right now if you know anything on this subject. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Mr. Bravo, 2 Golf X-ray Mike.
Mr. Golf X-ray Mike, go right ahead. Start off with your name, sir.
Good evening, Dick, from the TechNet. This is Rich, Whiskey Bravo, 2 Golf X-ray Mike. I just upgraded to Extra last year. Got all the details on that. They do not, by default, mail you a paper license. They provide you with an electronic license. Can, however, request at extra cost, the FCC will mail you a paper license. For no cost, you can download from the FCC a PDF file and print that out on a printer. That will be your paper license for no cost at all.
That's good information, Mike. So I can download it as a PDF and print it. And in theory, if I got the right kind of a printer, I can print it any size that I want. And I could request the FCC give me their issue. Now, some of these things that you download on the internet, they will have a message scrawled across it saying, for reference only. I wonder if that PDF gives you that for reference only scrolled across the page. And if you do request it from the FCC directly, you happen to know what that costs, Rich. KB2 or GXM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And download the reference only copy, but you can also, if you're authorized on the FCC website, you can download the actual license, and it will say watermark actual license. That, you can download that for free. As I said, you can also request the FCC to mail you a paper license for extra cost. I do not know how much that is.
Very good, Rich. Okay, but you've been there, you've done that. So let's see if John has got any further questions for Phil's on that. KC2QIW. Good luck with your new license there, Rich. John, KC2QIW. You got it, John.
This is Joe Small from Idaho. Joe. Yeah, roger that. The only problem is our printer is broken over here. So, unless I, first I gotta pass the test. And then, I guess I'm gonna, try to invest in a, printer that works, you know? And, I guess, that's all the questions I have for today. So, this is KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey, name is Joe, and back to the net. And, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, sorry about that, Joe. I wrote down the word Joe a little bit sloppy and it looked like John. One other solution you've got. You probably have a friend who has internet connection with a printer. So if you go over to that friend's house and you sign into that FCC site, I think there's a good chance that you can download to his computer and print it on his printer. I think that can be done. I can't see any reason why they would be against that, because the license has a very specific name, address, and call letters on it. So even if it goes to the wrong website, so to speak, I don't see how that can be a problem. So you probably got a friend with a computer with a printer. Give that a try, Joe. KC2QYW, K2LIW.
Yeah, it just reminded me. Roger that. We have a local nice guy over here, John Harrison Printers, and he has all the really good stuff equipment up there, and he always does all my fax papers for me and all like anything I need to be printed out and stuff. Yeah, so he'll definitely do it for me. So, thank you for reminding me about that. So, that's about it. Everything else is working good, and the squirrels are not bothering my coax cables outside anymore, outside the porch. Someone told me to tape up all the coax cables underneath the railing of the porch. So that's what I did, and so far it's working good. So, thank you guys, and love you guys, and thank you very much.
Got an additional comment, Dick? Yeah, I'm going to be going back to Joe with a question for him, but go right ahead, Eric. KE2EJ, KE2IW.
Oh, just to say Joe doesn't find his friend with the printer. And if you don't happen to have a computer, you can go get yourself a little thumb drive, or a USB drive, as they call it, and go to the public library. Of course, you're going to need your FRN number to get your license. Download it to the thumb drive, and then go over to Staples and have them print it for you. So, you can be completely clueless electronically and still get the end result. IWK2J.
Another very good suggestion. Thank you, Eric. Now, Joe, you had the squirrels disturbing your coax cables and taped them up. Does that mean by taping them, they're now held against the rafters of your porch and they're not hanging down so the squirrels can't get there? Or is there something about the tape that is repelling the squirrels? And by the way, I saw an advertisement today for something called Rodent Sheriff. There's a spray substance you can buy called Rodent Sheriff that everywhere you spray it, there's something about the smell will repel all rodents and raccoons and whatever. They come near it, and even if you sprayed it on their favorite food, sprayed it near their favorite food, they'll start walking toward their favorite food. They'll smell this stuff and take off in the other direction real fast. So, what did you do to protect your coax cables? Give us a few more words on that one, Joe. KC2QIW, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, roger that. My lucky guess is, when I started setting everything up new with the coax cables for the 2-meter antenna, vertical antenna, and the fan dipole. My mistake was, Dick, that I just left all the coax cables on the floor of the deck. You know, I just let them dangling on the floor, you know, because I don't really use the outside porch over here. I'm on the second floor. So my lucky guess is when I take them all up, on the wooden railing, I used electrical tape, just, you know, regular electrical tape. And I guess the squirrels are happy that I did that because, you know, they do hang out on the porch sometimes and, you know, walk around and go underneath the porch and do their business. I don't know what they're doing down there, but my lucky guess is probably making babies and whatnot. And ever since I taped them up, they don't bother the cables anymore. And that spray stuff is a good thing to have. But since they're not messing with the cables, maybe I don't need to space stuff. So to answer your question, Dick, yeah, that's what I did. I just taped them all up nice and neat, and it looks better now. So I just wish I would have did that years ago. So yeah, back to you.
And the one thing that's not clear to us, Joe, what were they doing before? Were they messing up your cable by depositing substance onto them, or were they chewing into your cables? What were they doing to your cables before that you didn't like? Over to you, Joe.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, roger that. I remember one morning I caught them in the act. You know, I looked out the window and... back and forth, like playing with it, and, but what happens is, the squirrel spikes in, so hard into that, 2 meter, collect cable that he bit, like, almost through the whole damn thing, so, you know, I don't think they're, trying to eat it, or use it for their nest or anything like that. I think they were just playing with it, you know, because there was two of them playing with it, you know, so.
Yeah, there's a slim chance that he thought that was nesting material. That if you could chew off a piece of it, he could make a nest with it. That's a guess on my part. Okay, we've gone down the list of everybody who signed in. Time for a little bit late in schedule to go over to the mailbag. John, first of all, when you looked at the Echo Link and IRLP, how many people did you see on our list of listening to us tonight? That's question number one. And question number two, what kind of deep questions have we gotten this week? And last week, we were trying to support that student who had a professor at college, a teacher, telling him that, no, you can't possibly get more power in your transmission line, more apparent forward power than the transmitter is putting out. A 100-watt transmitter cannot create 120 watts on the bird watt meter after your antenna tuner. And we were saying, absolutely, you can. You know, it seemed strange at first. So hopefully that person was able to convince his teacher. And even if not, he shouldn't be discouraged. Because I'm convinced that the phenomena is real. KC2 WTV, K2IW in the TechNet. Go right ahead, John.
KC2 WTV. Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone in the net. By the way, that chemical that you spray on things to prevent the rodents, which must chew because rodents, their teeth grow continuously, so they'll chew on anything to wear their teeth down. So it's a peppermint-based spray, believe it or not. It's something edible, but they don't like it, so they stay away. Also, mothballs do the same thing. So, yeah, I have an interesting question here from a youngster who built a sort of a pulse generator, and he has a question. So let me let it drop, and I'll go on with that question. Alrighty, this gentleman built basically it's a switch, turns on and turns off. Okay, it runs on a 6-volt battery, and when it turns on, it gets a nice rise time, and it stays on for about 100 milliseconds, and then it turns off, and he gets a nice pulse, a square wave, as he's calling it. It's pretty symmetrical. What his question is, he's heard discussion on the TechNet about the square waves containing many frequencies, and he wonders how that applies in this case when he only has a DC switch turning off and on, rises to the right amplitude, stays on for a certain time, and comes down. There's no apparent other frequencies in there, so maybe you could explain what's going on with that, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
Yeah, I think we can. If I built an oscillator, and if I used the right inductor and capacitor, I could make the oscillator run at, let me pick a number, 1 kilohertz. So this oscillator is running at 1 kilohertz, and it's making a beautiful sine wave if I design the oscillator just right. And I put it into right kind of laboratory instrumentation, like the audio spectrum analyzer in my case, and that's a machine that does exist. The Hewlett-Packard 3561 dynamic signal analyzer is a beautiful that would do that function for you. It would display all the frequencies present, and I hook up this output of this oscillator into my dynamic signal analyzer, that a name for I would call it is an audio spectrum analyzer. I'll see a pip on the screen at exactly 1 kilohertz, and depending on the quality of my oscillator, I might see another very weak signal at 2 kilohertz, because every oscillator has some amount of second harmonic and third harmonic, but they're usually very highly suppressed. You look on an oscilloscope, you see the most beautiful round sine wave. If you look at it with a spectrum analyzer, you'd see the second harmonic 60 decibels down, 1/1,000,000th of the power. You would never see that little extra wiggle on the sine wave of an oscilloscope. If the other frequency in there, a little bit of flat topping, so to speak, represents 1/1,000,000th of the power, 60 dB down, your oscilloscope would never show it to you. But your spectrum analyzer might have 80 or 100 decibels of dynamic range, and it can see it. Okay, that's a pure sine wave. Now, Mr. Fourier, beautiful mathematician, French, I think, came to the conclusion that you take any particular waveform, triangular wave, square wave, delta wave,
repeater, timeout.
Mr. Fourier basically said mathematically in his day that if you take any particular crazy waveform that is a repetitive signal, as long as you've got a repetitive signal, no matter what shape it has, take the right mixture of the fundamental frequency, the second harmonic, the third harmonic, the fourth harmonic, you take all of those harmonics, set them up with the right amplitude ratio and the right phase angle. Maybe it's just amplitude ratio. Yeah, I think it's only amplitude ratio. You take the right amplitude ratio of all possible frequencies that are a harmonic of your fundamental frequency, of your repetitive, crazy waveform. You take the right combination of those, and you can reconstruct that waveform with nothing but pure sine waves. Let me drop. If you take the right mixture of pure, continuous sine waves, the right amplitude ratio of those, add them all together with a summing circuit, so to speak, and you can reconstruct any waveform that isn't multi-valued. By that I mean, if at a particular point in time your crazy waveform is both positive and negative simultaneously, no, you cannot do that. As long as your particular voltage waveform at each instant of time has one single value of voltage, no matter how crazy that waveform is, you take the right mixture of sine waves and it will reconstruct that wave for you. Okay. Now, if you take a perfect square wave, which is 50% of the time positive and 50% of the time negative, and you study the Fourier series for it, you'll find out it has nothing but odd harmonics. It's got 100% fundamental, and I'm not sure of the exact number, but maybe it's 30% of the third harmonic, and maybe 15% of the fifth harmonic, and a certain amount of the seventh harmonic. It has nothing but odd harmonics. That's the crazy characteristic of a thoroughly symmetric square wave. If you now had an ability to twist a knob on your square wave generator, let me drop it. If you had a knob where you could start twisting on your square wave generator, so that instead of it being 50% positive and 50% negative as a perfect square wave, with zero time for rise and zero time for fall between those two states, and you now twist this knob so that it goes from 50 to 51% positive and 49% negative. You twist that knob and you look at your spectrum analyzer and you suddenly realize that the even harmonics that previously were not there, all of a sudden they start coming up out of the noise. The second harmonic, fourth harmonic, and sixth harmonic that were not there at all with a perfect square wave, they start coming up. That gives you a very interesting characteristic. Assuming now that your characteristic, your requirement, is to make a perfect square wave where it's exactly 50.00% positive and 50.00% negative and nothing in between, and your oscilloscope cannot read that as accurately as what you would like, but you happen to have an audio spectrum analyzer, and you twist that knob that adjusts the amount of positive versus negative time of your square wave waveform. Let me drop this. And you twist that knob until all of the even harmonics go to zero on that spectrum analyzer screen. So you're now left with nothing but fundamental, third harmonic, fifth harmonic, seventh harmonic, and so on. When you twist the knob so that the even harmonics disappear on the screen, even though you're not looking at the waveform directly, you now have exactly 50.0% positive and 50% zero negative. There's a catch here now. Almost every square wave generator has the equivalent of an amplifier somewhere, and when you try to put a perfect square wave into an amplifier where you're expecting the leading edge to have zero time for rise and the trailing edge to have zero time for fall, almost every real amplifier will do a little bit of ringing. It'll do a little bit of overshoot on the rise and a little bit of undershoot on the fall, so to speak. Almost every real amplifier does that. Unfortunately, that ringing creates some other frequency components which might complicate a little bit things here. Now, let me think about that. Yeah, would those rings, would the overshoot rings be exactly harmonically related? They might not. They might be other frequency components. So the bottom line of what Mr. Fourier discovered, and mathematically, let me drop this, that with nothing but pure sine waves of the right amplitude ratio, you can reconstruct any repetitive waveform. That's Fourier. There's also something called Walsh function. Mr. Walsh came up with a parallel piece of electronic, a parallel piece of theory, mathematical theory, that if you take the right combination of square waves of the right frequencies and put them together, you can reconstruct any waveform, he thinks. That's a much more complicated process. Don't go there. So doing it with sine waves is the easy way, and Fourier series tells you how to do that. F-O-U-I-R-I-E-R, something like that. It's a French name. You Google the word Fourier and Fourier series. A little bit complicated mathematically, but it will confirm for you that any repetitive waveform can be reconstructed with nothing but pure sine waves. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
Comment?
Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, that ringing, or that undershooting, that thing that makes it tilt in the audio world or in the op-amp world, it's really. And in transmitters and stuff like that, we call that group delay. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, where that usually comes up, group delay distortion, either a filter or a waveguide. A signal you send down a waveguide is going to bounce back and forth between the narrow walls. However, no matter what frequency you send down that waveguide, there is some very exact angle of every one of those bounces for that particular frequency. The higher frequencies go down the waveguide at a much more shallow angle of bounce. They come closer to a grazing angle. Therefore, the higher frequency components of a broadband signal go down a waveguide faster than the lower frequency components. That difference in timing at the far end, where the high frequency components arrive first, they call that group delay distortion. Filters do it, waveguides do it, a lot of things do it. In the case of an elaborate signal, like a color television signal back in the analog days, the fact that the higher frequencies get there sooner means that the phase angle of the chrominant signal gets disturbed, and as I used to say, Johnny Carson's face turns green because of group delay distortion. Something very difficult to live with. Now with digital techniques, my guess is you have even more severe requirements for controlling group delay distortion. I think if a modern 8 VSB signal is sent down a piece of highly dispersive waveguide, my guess is that distortion is kind of hard for your receiving circuit to live with. Is that roughly true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW, and TechNet?
K2RIW, K2EJ. Actually, the part where Johnny's Carson's face turns green, that's what we call differential phase. And the part where Johnny's skin tone gets thin and light and almost black and white, we call that differential amplitude. because you got two main, you know, you have two oscillators going main, you need to play from each other. But in the digital world, loop delay distortion is a real killer, but what we do is sort the signal before we step into all that stuff. So it's, when it finally comes out in the end, it looks right.
Is that pre-distortion circuit called a group delay distortion eliminator? What words do you use for that fancy circuit, Eric? And I'll bet you that circuit, in some cases, has a whole lot of knobs that have to be set just right. Go ahead, Eric.
Oh, Mr. Sylvester, I'm sorry, there are no knobs. We do things with computers and bit slices and VLSIs that have incredible smarts, and that it would actually have to happen a lot faster than a human being can deal with it. And it can be dynamic, so it can actually follow changes. Every manufacturer has their quote-unquote trade name for that series of circuits, because it's not just single circuits. I mean, we are talking about amplitude modulation to start with. We are talking about random number generators making, filling up time and doing things that are dynamically moving all the time. One of my transmitters has something called a MODAP, and it takes care of modulation and differential phases, which in the added up, adds up to group delay. And what it does is looks at the signal that's coming out and makes corrections. There's a couple of series of lookup tables that have to be ready to drop. And those lookup tables describe the shape and dynamics and the timing of the waveforms that are being generated as it passes through amplifiers, right, you know, from the modulator through the amplifiers, right into the feed line. And because most antennas are not that much of an issue with the feed line, even waveguides, we tend to
And sure enough, with modern-day computer-generated circuitry, computer-controlled circuitry, control all of that. Now, when it comes to a square-wave generator, there was a very simple one-transistor oscillator circuit that made the most beautiful-looking square waves you could ever see that appeared in an issue of Popular Electronics magazine, roughly 1958-59, as I remember. I had that issue of Popular Electronics. It was a very simple circuit. It ran on a 1.5-volt battery. I think I'm not sure if I ran it on a C cell or a AA. Anyhow, the circuit only drew 1 milliampere. As I said, it made this most beautiful looking square wave at exactly 1.5 volts, positive to negative ratio, peak to peak. And because the circuit did such a beautiful square wave, I put it on my oscilloscope. I wasn't smart enough to calculate how much current it's drawing and how long it would last. So I left my oscilloscope turned on. It was an old Dumont oscilloscope, as I remember, ancient thing. So I left the oscilloscope turned on for a solid 2 weeks, and that oscillator running for 2 weeks. And I think the oscillator, if it drew 1 milliamp and it was a C cell that was good for 2 ampere hours, that means it would run for 2,000 hours. That's a whole lot of time. The bottom line was I let my oscilloscope and that circuit run continuously, and for the rest of the life of that oscilloscope,
nice burn, huh?
There was a nice burned mark on that oscilloscope screen with that beautiful square wave. So everything I would look at with that oscilloscope from then on, I would see that square wave on the screen, because that circuit was so much fun to watch it continuously do that day in and day out, hour after hour. And so that was my first connection with a square wave generator. And that circuit was so simple, and it had absolutely no
repeater. Time out.
It was so simple, it had no overshoot on the screen. Beautiful looking square waves that got burned into my screen. So that was my, I wasn't smart enough in those days to know that there's something called a spectrum analyzer where I could actually see the ratio of on to off and so on. Astable multivibrator is one of the techniques That's one of the circuits, one of the words that used to be used for a square wave generator in the old days of computer-generated circuits.
We still use it.
Okay, so it's still called an A-stable multivibrator. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
This is an A-stable, need two transistors?
It doesn't have to be two transistors. Classically, it is. But there's a way of doing it with one transistor. And that popular electronics article did it way back in 1959, so to speak. Over to you, John.
Not forget monostable multivibrators either.
If you get the benefit of what he's talking about, I think it would be best for him to see if he could borrow an audio spectrum analyzer, and he will possibly see something different than he sees with his oscilloscope. Although it looks perfect on the scope, it's not really happening the way he thought. You know, and he figured that because he's using a battery and a simple switch, that there was no AC component involved at all. So, very good. Okay, let me let it drop and I'll go on to the next one.
ZPZ, to make a sine wave for a trigger and also get some good square waves.
There is a fancy circuit called Schmidt trigger. That's what the Hal's bringing to our attention. The Schmidt trigger has some exact threshold voltage, which might be, let me pick a number, 7/10 of a volt. If you give it more than 7/10 of a volt, the output of the Schmidt trigger will be positive maximum. Give it less than 7/10 of a volt, the output will be negative voltage maximum. Schmidt trigger does that for you. In the case of a stable multivibrator, it really is flipping back and forth. And one way of doing it is with two transistors that one conducts and the other doesn't conduct, and it does it for a certain length of time, an RC time constant, and they flip back and forth. There is a way of doing it where your one single transistor turns on and turns off for a certain length of time, again, determined by an RC network. So, classically, it's done with two transistors. There is a way of doing it with one. You may not get a perfect symmetric square wave with one. I'm not sure about that. Yeah, there is a way of making it symmetric. But with two transistors and the flip-flop, it's a little bit more easy to see what's going on. But oscillators are a very basic circuit used in a zillion places in radio receivers and radio transmitters. So learning anything you can about oscillators. Let me drop.
Comment, Dick. K6DTZ.
Go ahead, Hal.
I'm going to ask stable multivibrator. You don't want perfectly matched transistors. It'll never start.
There's a yes and a no to that. As long as the network is biased in the way that the amplifiers are active, because every amplifier has some amount of noise, the noise generated within the transistor, no matter how small it is, will kick it into oscillation. If your particular circuit starts off with bias where your transistors, where your individual amplifiers have a inactive state, then yes, you might sit there and not oscillate. But if they are truly active, if there really is feedback, no matter how well balanced your transistors are, I believe it will always start on noise. Let's see what Eric's going to say about that. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
If you have transistors with exact data, they will not start. I've experienced that.
How do you know that your two circuits were thoroughly active when you first started up? Were both transistors biased in such a way that they were thoroughly active and there really was positive feedback with greater than unity gain? No matter how well balanced they are, there's a bunch of books that'll tell you that they must oscillate and it'll be kicked over by their noise, if nothing else. Over to you for a rebuttal on that one, Hal.
No rebuttal. I've worked with perfectly matched data devices and I couldn't get the darn things to go in that stable state. But generally, stuff off the shelf, you're not going to find two exact data where one will always start to conduct before the other and it'll kick it into your oscillation.
KE2EJ, go ahead, Eric.
K2RWK2J. Well, I live in the digital world and we generally don't do that anymore. It's quickly. I mean, if you want to go back a few years, or this story is today, most of the time when we're generating square waves, it depends upon what frequency range you're looking at. If you're looking at hundreds of megahertz, we get chips that do that too. But 74121, good A stable multi-band beta, 74122 at 123.